I wasn't entirely sure what drove me to keep going. Perhaps it was my cold fury at Tanya Horton Miller's semi-detached parenting. Perhaps it was my guilt at having failed to do the thing I was criticizing Tanya for not doing. Perhaps it was just that I knew only too well how vulnerable a young girl could be. Mostly, though, it was Will. I walked and drove and questioned and walked and held endless internal conversations with him as my hip began to ache, and I paused in my car chewing stale sandwiches and garage chocolate and choking down painkillers to keep me going. Where would she go, Will? What would you do? And, yet again, I'm sorry. I let you down. Any news? I texted Sam. It felt odd speaking to him while having concurrent conversations with Will in my head. A strange infidelity. I wasn't quite sure who I was being unfaithful to. No, I've called every ER department in London. How about you? Bit tired? Hip? Nothing chewing a few Nurofen won't fix. You want me to stop by after my shift? I think I just need to keep looking. Don't go anywhere I wouldn't go. Kiss. Very funny. Kiss, kiss, kiss. Did you try the hospitals? My sister called from college in her 15-minute break between HMRC, the changing face of revenue collection, and VAT, a European perspective. Sam says there's nobody with her name has been admitted to any of the teaching hospitals. He's got people everywhere out looking for her. I glanced behind me as I spoke, as if even then I half expected to see Lily walking out of the crowds towards me. How long have you been looking? A few days. I didn't tell her I'd barely slept. I took time off work. I knew it. I knew she was going to be trouble. Did your boss mind you taking time off? What happened about the other job, by the way? The one in New York? Did you do the interview? Oh, please don't say you forgot. It took me a minute to work out what she was referring to. Oh, that. Yeah. I got it. You what? Nathan said they're going to offer it to me. Westminster was filling with tourists, lingering at gaudy stalls of Union Jack tat, their mobile phones and expensive cameras held aloft to capture the looming Houses of Parliament. I watched a traffic warden walking towards me and wondered if some anti-terrorism legislation prevented me parking where I'd stopped. I held up a hand indicating that I was about to leave. There was a short silence on the other end of the phone. Hang on. You're not saying you... I can't even think about it right now, Treen. Lily's missing. I need to find her. Louisa, you listen a minute. You have to take this job. What? This is the opportunity of a lifetime. If you had the faintest clue what I would give for a chance to move to New York with guaranteed employment, a place to live, and you can't think about it right now. It's not as simple as that. The traffic warden was definitely walking towards me. Oh, my God, this is it. This is the thing I was trying to talk to you about. Every time you get a chance to move forward, you just hijack your own future. It's like you don't actually want to. Lily is missing, Treen. A 16-year-old girl you barely know, with two parents and at least two grandparents, has buggered off for a few days like she's done before. Like teenagers sometimes do. And you're going to use this to throw away the greatest opportunity you're ever likely to be given. Jeez, you don't even really want to go, do you? What the hell is that supposed to mean? Far easier for you to just stick with that depressing little job and complain about it. It's far easier for you to just sit tight and not take a risk and make out that everything that happens to you is something you couldn't help. I can't just up and leave while this is going on. You're in charge of your own life, Lou. And yet you act like you're permanently buffeted by events outside your control. What is this? Guilt? Is it that you feel you owe Will something? Is it some kind of penance, giving up your life because you couldn't save his? You don't understand. No, I understand perfectly. I understand you better than you understand yourself. His daughter is not your responsibility. Do you hear me? None of this is your responsibility. And if you don't go to New York, an opportunity I can't even talk about because it makes me want to actually kill you. I'll never talk to you again. Ever. The traffic warden was at my window. I wound it down, pulling the universal face you make when your sister is going off on one at the other end of your phone, and you're really sorry, but you can't cut her short. He tapped his watch, and I nodded reassuringly. That's it, Lou. Think about it. Lily is not your daughter. I was left staring at my phone. I thanked the traffic warden, then wound up my window, and a phrase popped into my head. I'm not his daughter. I drove around the corner, pulled up beside a petrol station, and rifled through the battered old A to Z that lived in the footwell of my car, trying to remember the name of the road Lily had mentioned. Pymore? Pycrust? Pycroft! I traced the distance to St. John's Wood with my finger. Would that take 15 minutes to walk? It had to be the same place. I used my phone and looked up his surname along with the street name, and there it was. Number 56. My gut tightened with excitement. I started the ignition, wrenched the car into gear, and headed out onto the road again. Although separated by less than a mile, the difference between Lily's mother's house and her former stepfather's could not have been more pronounced. Where the Horton Miller Street was uniformly grand, white stucco or red brick houses, punctuated by yew topiary and large cars that seemingly never got dirty, Martin Seals Road appeared resolutely ungentrified. A two-story corner of London where house prices were spiralling, but the exteriors resolutely refused to reflect it. I drove slowly, past cars under canvas and an overturned wheelie bin, and finally found a parking space near a small Victorian terraced house of the kind that existed in identikit lines all over London. I gazed at it, noting the peeling paintwork on the front door, the child's watering can on the front step. "Please let her be here," I prayed. "Safe within those walls." I climbed out of the car, locked it, and walked up to the front step. Inside I could hear a piano, a fractured chord being repeated again and again, muffled voices. I hesitated, just a moment. And then I pressed the doorbell, hearing the sudden answering stop to the music. Footsteps in the corridor, and then the door opened. A 40-something man, lumberjack shirt, jeans, and day-old stubble stood there. "Yes?" I wondered, is Lily here, please?
Lily?
I smiled, held out a hand. You are Martin Steele, yes? He studied me briefly before he answered.
I might be. And who are you?
I'm a friend of Lily's. I've been trying to get in contact with her, and I understand that she might be staying here, or that perhaps you might know where she is. He frowned.
Lily? Lily Miller?
Well, yes. He rubbed his hand against his jaw and glanced behind him towards the hall. "Could you wait there a moment, please?" He walked back down the corridor, and I heard him issuing instructions to whoever was at the piano. As he came back to me, a scale began playing, hesitantly, and then with more emphasis. Martin Steele half closed the door behind him. He dipped his head for a moment, as if he were trying to make sense of what I had asked him. "I'm sorry, I'm slightly at a loss here. You're a friend of Lily Miller's, and you've come here, why?" "Because Lily said she came here to see you." "You were her stepfather?"
"Well, not technically, but yes, a long time ago."
"And you're a musician? You used to take her to nursery? But you're still in contact. She told me how close you still were, how much it irritated her mother." Martin squinted at me. "Miss Clark, Louisa Clark." "Miss Clark, Louisa. I haven't seen Lily Miller since she was 5 years old. Tanya thought it would be better for all of us when we split up if we broke off all contact." I stared at him. "So you're saying she hasn't been here?" He thought for a moment. "Oh, she came once a few years ago, but it wasn't great timing. We just had a baby and I was trying to teach and, well, to be honest, I couldn't work out what she really wanted from me."
"So you haven't seen or spoken to her since then?" "Apart from that one very brief occasion, no."
"Is she okay? Is she in some kind of trouble?" Inside, the piano kept playing. Do, re, mi, fa, so, la, ti, do. Do, ti, la, so, fa, mi, re, do. Up and down. I waved a hand, already backing away down the steps. "No, it's fine. My mistake. I'm sorry to have bothered you." I spent another evening driving around London, ignoring my sister's calls and the email from Richard Percival that was marked urgent and personal. I drove until my eyes were reddened from the glare of lights and I realised I was going to places I'd already been, and I ran out of cash for petrol. I drove home just after midnight, promising myself I would pick up my bank card, drink a cup of tea, rest my eyes for half an hour, then hit the road again.
I took my shoes off and made some toast that I couldn't eat. Instead, I swallowed another 2 painkillers and lay back on the sofa, my mind racing. What was I missing? There must be some clue. My brain buzzed with exhaustion, my stomach now permanently knotted with anxiety. What streets had I missed? Was there a chance she had gone somewhere other than London? There was no choice, I decided. We had to let the police know. It was better to be thought stupid and overly dramatic than to risk something actually happening to her. I lay back and closed my eyes for 5 minutes. I was woken 3 hours later by the phone ringing. I lurched upright, temporarily unsure where I was. Then I stared at the flashing screen beside me and fumbled it up to my ear. Hello?
We've got her.
What?
It's Sam.
We've got Lily. Can you come? In the evening crush that followed England losing a football match, the ill temper and associated drink-related injuries, nobody had noticed the slight figure sleeping across 2 chairs in the corner, her hoodie pulled up high over her face. It was only when the triage nurse had gone person to person to ensure they were meeting waiting targets that someone shook the girl awake, and she confessed reluctantly that she was just there because it was warm and dry and safe. The nurse was questioning her when Sam, bringing in an old woman with breathing problems, caught sight of her at the desk. He had quietly instructed the nurses at the desk not to let her leave and hurried out to call me before she could see him. He told me all this as we rushed into A&E. The waiting area had finally started to thin out and the fever-ridden children safely in cubicles with their parents, the drunks sent home to sleep it off. Only RTAs and stabbing victims at this time of night. They've given her some tea. She looks exhausted. I think she's happy just to sit tight. I must have looked anxious at this point because he added, "It's okay. They won't let her leave." I half walked, half ran along the strip corridor, Sam striding behind me. And there she was, looking somehow smaller than she had done. Her hair pulled into a messy plait, a plastic cup held between her thin hands. A nurse sat beside her working through a pile of folders. And when she saw me and registered Sam, she smiled warmly and stood up to leave. Lily's nails, I noticed, were black with grime. "Lily," I said. Her dark, shadowed eyes met mine. "What happened? She looked at me, and then at Sam, her eyes huge and a little fearful. "We've been looking everywhere. We were... My God, Lily, where were you?" "Sorry," she whispered. I shook my head, trying to tell her that it didn't matter, that nothing could possibly matter, that the only important thing was that she was safe and she was here. I held out my arms. She looked into my eyes, took a step forward and gently came to rest against me. I closed my arms tight around her, feeling her silent, shaking sobs become my own. All I could do was thank some unknown God and offer up these silent words. Will, we found her.
Chapter 21. The first night home, I put Lily in my bed and she slept for 18 hours, waking in the evening for some soup and a bath, then crashing out for a further 8. I slept on the sofa, the front door locked, afraid to go out or even to move in case she vanished again. Sam dropped in twice before and after his shift to bring milk and to check on how she'd been, and we talked in whispers in the hall as if we were discussing an invalid. I rang Tanya Horton Miller to tell her that her daughter had turned up safely. "I told you, you wouldn't listen to me," she crowed triumphantly, and I put the phone down before she could say anything else, or I did. I called Mrs. Traynor, who let out a long, shaking sigh of relief and didn't speak for some time. "Thank you," she said finally, and it sounded like it came from somewhere deep in her gut. "When can I come and see her?" I finally opened the email from Richard Percival, which informed me that, "As you have been given the requisite 3 warnings, it is considered that given your poor attendance, record and failure to carry out your contractual requirements, your employment at the Shamrock and Clover Airport is terminated with immediate effect." He asked that I return the uniform, including wig, at my earliest convenience, or you will be charged its full retail value. I opened an email from Nathan asking, "Where the hell are you? Have you seen my last email?" I thought about Mr. Gopnik's offer, and with a sigh, closed my computer. On the third day, I woke on the sofa to find Lily missing. My heart lurched reflexively until I saw the open hallway window. I climbed up the fire escape and found her seated on the roof looking out across the city. She was wearing her pyjama bottoms, which I'd washed, and Will's oversized sweater. "Hey," I said, walking across the roof towards her.
You have food in your fridge, she observed. Ambulance Sam. And you watered everything.
That was mostly him, too. She nodded as if that were probably to be expected. I took my place on the bench and we sat in companionable silence for a while, breathing in the scent of the lavender, whose purple heads had burst out of their tight green buds. Everything in the little roof garden had now exploded into gaudy life, the petals and whispering leaves bringing colour and movement and fragrance to the grey expanse of asphalt. Sorry for hogging your bed. Your need was greater.
You hung up all your clothes.
She curled her legs neatly under her, tucking her hair behind an ear. She was still pale.
The nice ones.
Well, I guess you made me think I shouldn't hide them in boxes any more. She shot me a sideways look and a small sad smile that somehow made me feel sadder than if she hadn't smiled at all. The air held the promise of a scorching day, the street sounds muffled as if by the warmth of the sun. You could feel it already seeping through the windows, bleaching the air. Below us, the bin lorry clattered and roared its way along the curbside to a tympanic accompaniment of beeps and men's voices.
Lily, I said quietly when it had finally receded into the distance, what's going on?
I tried not to sound too interrogative. I know I'm not meant to ask you questions and I'm not your actual family or anything, but all I can see is that something's gone wrong here and I feel we're sort of related, and I just want you to trust me. I want you to feel you can talk to me.
She kept her gaze fixed on her hands.
I'm not going to judge you. I'm not going to report anything you say to anyone.
You have to know that if you tell someone the truth, it will help. I promise. It will make things better.
Says who?
Me.
There's nothing you can't tell me, Lily.
Really?
She glanced at me, then looked away.
You won't understand,
she said softly.
And then I knew.
Below us it had become oddly quiet, or perhaps I could no longer hear anything beyond the few inches that separated us.
I'm going to tell you a story, I said.
Only one person in the whole world knows this story because it was something I didn't feel I could share for years and years. And telling him changed the whole way I felt about it, and how I felt about myself. So here's the thing. You don't have to tell me anything at all, but I'm going to trust you enough to tell you my story anyway, just in case it will help. I waited a moment, but Lily didn't protest or roll her eyes, or say it was going to be boring. She wrapped her arms around her knees and she listened. She listened as I told her about the teenage girl who, on a glorious summer evening, had celebrated a little too hard in a place she considered safe. How she had been surrounded by her girlfriends and some nice boys who seemed as if they came from good families and knew the rules. And how much fun it had been. How funny and crazy and wild. Until, some drinks later, she realized nearly all the other girls had drifted away, and the laughter had grown hard. And the joke, it turned out, had been on her. And I told her, without going into too much detail, how that evening had ended, with a sister silently helping her home, her shoes lost, bruising in secret places in a big black hole where her recall of those hours should have been, and the memories, fleeting and dark, now hanging over her head to remind her every day that she had been stupid, irresponsible, and had brought it all on herself, and how for years she had let that thought colour what she did, where she went and what she thought she was capable of, and how sometimes it just needed someone to say something as simple as,
no, it wasn't your fault. It really wasn't your fault.
I finished and Lily was still watching me. Her expression gave no clue to her reaction.
I don't know what was or is going on with you, Lily, I said carefully.
It might be totally unrelated to what I've just told you. I just want you to know there is nothing so bad you can't tell me. And there is nothing you could do that would make me close a door on you again. Still, she didn't speak. I gazed out over the roof terrace, deliberately not looking at her.
You know, your dad said something to me that I've never forgotten.
You don't have to let that one thing be the thing that defines you.
My dad?
She lifted her chin.
I nodded.
Whatever it is that's happened, even if you don't want to tell me, you need to understand that he was right. These last weeks, months,
don't have to be the thing that defines you. Even from the little I know of you, I recognise that you are bright and funny and kind and smart, and that if you can get yourself past whatever this is, you have an amazing future ahead. How can you possibly know that? Because you're like him. You're even wearing his jumper, I added softly. She brought her arm slowly to her face, placing the soft wool against her cheek, thinking. I sat back on the bench. I wondered if I had pushed it too far, talking about Will. But then Lily took a breath, and in a quiet, uncharacteristically flat voice, she told me the truth about where she'd been. She told me about the boy, and about the man, and an image on a mobile phone that haunted her, and the days she had spent as a shadow on the city's neon-lit streets. As she spoke, she started to cry, shrinking into herself, her face crumpling like that of a 5-year-old. So I moved across the seat and brought her in close to me, stroking her hair while she kept talking. Her words now jumbled, too fast, too full, broken with sobs and hiccups. By the time she got to the last day, she was huddled into me, swallowed by the jumper, swallowed by her own fear and guilt and sadness. "I'm sorry," she sobbed. "I'm so sorry." "You have nothing," I said fiercely as I held her. "Nothing to be sorry for." That evening Sam came. He was cheerful, sweet and casual in his dealings with Lily, cooked us pasta with cream, bacon and mushrooms when she said she didn't want to go out, and we watched a comedy film about a family who got lost in a jungle, a strange facsimile of a family ourselves. I smiled and laughed and made tea, but inside I simmered with anger I didn't dare show. As soon as Lily went to bed, I beckoned Sam onto the fire escape. We climbed up to the roof where I could be sure I wouldn't be heard, and as he sat down on the little wrought iron bench, I told him what she had told me in that spot just a few hours earlier. "She thinks it's going to hang over her forever." "He still has the phone, Sam." I wasn't sure I had ever been so furious. All evening as the television burbled in front of me, I had recast the last weeks in a new light. I thought about the times the boy had hung around downstairs, the way Lily had hidden her phone under the sofa cushions when she thought I might see it, the way she had sometimes flinched when a new message came through. I thought of her stuttering words, of the way she described her relief when she thought she had been rescued, and then the horror of what was to come next. I thought about the arrogance of a man who had seen a young girl in distress and viewed it as an opportunity. Sam motioned to me to sit down, but I couldn't keep still. I paced backwards and forwards across the roof terrace, my fists tight, my neck rigid. I wanted to throw things over the edge. I wanted to find Mr. Garside. He came and stood behind me and rubbed at the knots in my shoulders. I suspected it was his way of making me stand still. "I actually want to kill him." "It can be arranged." I looked round at Sam to see if he was joking, and was the tiniest bit disappointed when I saw he was. It had grown chilly up there in the stiff night breeze, and I wished I had brought up a jacket. "Maybe we should go to the police. It's blackmail, isn't it?" "He'll deny it." There are a million places he could hide a phone, and if her mother was telling the truth, nobody is going to believe Lily over a so-called pillar of the community. That's how these people get away with it. "But how do we get that phone off him? She won't be able to move forward while she knows he's out there, while that image is still out there." I was shivering. Sam took his jacket off and hung it around my shoulders. It carried the residual warmth of him, and I tried not to look as grateful as I felt. "We can't turn up at his office, or her parents will find out. We could email him. Tell him he has to send it back, or else." "He's hardly going to cough it up. He might not even answer an email. That could be used as evidence." "Oh, it's hopeless," I let out a long moan. "Maybe she's just going to have to learn to live with it. Maybe we can convince her that it's as much in his interest to forget what happened as it is hers. Because it is, right? I mean, maybe he'll just get rid of the phone himself." "What, you think she'll go with that?" "No," I rubbed my eyes. "I can't bear it. I can't bear that he'll get away with it. That creepy, nasty, manipulative, limo-driving scumbag." I stood out and gazed at the city below me, feeling briefly despairing. I could see the future. Lily, defensive and wild as she tried to escape the shadow of her past. That phone was the key to her behaviour, to her future, Think, I told myself. Think what Will would do.
He would not have let this man win. I had to strategize like he would.
I watched the traffic creeping slowly past the front door of my block. I thought of Mr. Garside's big black car cruising the streets of Soho. I thought about a man who moved silently and easily through life, confident that it would always work his way. Sam, I said, is there a drug you could give that could stop someone's heart? He let that hang in the air for a moment. Please tell me you're kidding. No. Listen, I've got an idea. She said nothing at first. You'll be safe, I said, and this way nobody has to know a thing. What moved me most was that she didn't ask me the question I had been asking myself ever since I outlined my plan to Sam. How do you know this will actually work?
I've got it all lined up, sweetheart, Sam said.
But nobody else knows.
Anything, just that he's hassling you.
Won't you get into trouble?
Don't worry about me.
She pulled at her sleeve, then murmured, and you won't leave me with him at all?
Not for 1 minute.
She chewed her lip, then she looked at Sam and over at me, and something seemed to settle inside her. Okay, let's do it. I bought a cheap pay-as-you-go handset, called Lily's stepfather's workplace, and got Mr. Garside's mobile number from his secretary by pretending we had arranged to meet for a drink. That evening, as I waited for Sam to arrive, I sent a text to Garside's number. Mr. Garside, I'm sorry about hitting you. I just freaked. I want to sort it out. L. He left at 30 minutes before responding, probably to make her sweat.
Why should I talk to you, Lily? You were very rude after all the help I gave you.
Prick, muttered Sam. I know. I'm sorry. But I do need your help.
This is not a one-way street, Lily.
I know. You just gave me a shock. I needed time to think. Let's meet up. I'll give you what you want, but you have to give me the phone first.
I don't think you get to dictate terms, Lily.
Sam looked at me. I looked back at him, then began to type. Not even if I'm a really bad girl. A pause.
Now you've got my interest.
Sam and I exchanged a look.
I just a little sick in my mouth, I said.
Tomorrow night, then, I typed. I'll send you the address when I've checked my friend will be out. When we were sure he wouldn't respond, Sam put the phone into his pocket where Lily couldn't see it and held me for a long time. I was almost ill with nerves the next day, and Lily was worse. We picked at our breakfast, and I let Lily smoke in the flat and was almost tempted to ask for a cigarette myself. We watched a film and did some chores badly, and by 7:30 that evening when Sam arrived, my head was buzzing so much I could barely speak.
Did you send the address? I asked him.
Yep. Show me. The phone message was simply the address of my flat and signed L. He had responded.
I have a meeting in town, and I'll be there shortly after 8.
You okay? He said. My stomach tightened. I felt as if I could hardly breathe. I don't want to get you into trouble. I mean, what if you get found out? You'll lose your job. Sam shook his head.
Won't happen.
I shouldn't have pulled you into this mess. You've been so brilliant, and I feel like I'm repaying you by putting you at risk.
We'll be fine. Keep breathing.
He smiled reassuringly at me, but I thought I could detect a faint strain around his eyes. He glanced over my shoulder, and I turned. Lily was wearing a black T-shirt, denim shorts and black tights, and she had done her makeup so she looked simultaneously very beautiful and very young. Are you all right, sweetheart? She nodded. Her skin, normally the slightly olive colour Will's had been, was unusually pale. Her eyes were huge in her face.
It's all going to be fine. I'd be surprised if it takes longer than 5 minutes.
Lou's been through it all with you, yes? Sam's voice was calm, reassuring. We had rehearsed it 12 times. I wanted her to reach a point where she wouldn't freeze, where she could repeat her lines without thinking. I know what I'm doing.
Right, he said, and clapped his hands together. 7:45. Let's get ready.
He was punctual. I had to give him that. At 8:01, my buzzer rang. Lily took an audible breath. I squeezed her hand, and then she answered the entry phone. Yes, yes, she's gone. Come up. It didn't seem to occur to him that she might not be what he thought. Lily let him in. Only I, watching through the crack in my bedroom door, could see the way her hand trembled as she reached for the lock. Garside ran his hand over his hair, glanced briefly around the hallway. He was wearing a good grey suit and tucked his car keys into his inside breast pocket. I couldn't stop staring at him, at his expensive shirt, his beady, acquisitive eyes as they scanned the flat. My jaw tightened. What kind of man felt entitled to press himself on a girl 40 years younger than he was, to blackmail the child of his own colleague? He looked uncomfortable, far from relaxed. "I've parked my car out the back. Will it be safe?"
"I think so," Lily swallowed.
"You think so?" He took a step back towards the door, the kind of man who sees his car as an extension of some minuscule part of himself. "And what about your friend, whoever owns this place? They're not coming back?" I held my breath. Behind me I felt Sam's steadying hand on the small of my back.
"Oh, no, it'll be fine," she smiled, suddenly reassuring. "She won't be back for ages. Do come in. Would you like a drink, Mr. Garside?"
He looked at her as if he were seeing her for the first time. So formal. He took a step forward and finally closed the door behind him. "Do you have scotch?"
"I'll check. Come through."
She began to walk to the kitchen, him following, removing his suit jacket. As they entered the living room, Sam walked past me out of the bedroom, strode across the hallway in his heavy boots and locked the inside door to the flat, placing the keys jangling in his pocket. Garside, startled, turned and saw him, joined now by Donna. They stood there, in uniform, against the door. He looked at them, then back at Lily and Falter, trying to work out what was going on.
"Hello, Mr. Garside," I said, stepping out from behind the door. "I believe you have something to return to my friend here."
He actually broke out in a spontaneous sweat. Until then, I hadn't known it was physically possible. His eyes darted about for Lily, but as I had stepped out into the hall, she had moved so that she was half behind me. Sam stepped forward. Mr. Garside's head reached just above his shoulder.
"The phone, please."
"You can't threaten me."
"We're not threatening you," I said, my heart thumping.
"We would just like the phone."
"You're threatening me just by blocking my exit."
"Oh, no, sir," said Sam. "Actually, threatening you would involve me mentioning the fact that if my colleague and I chose, we could pin you down right here and now and inject you with dihypranol, which would slow and ultimately stop your heart. Now that would be a threat, especially as nobody would question the word of a paramedic crew who had apparently tried to save you, and as dihypranol is one of the few drugs that leaves no trace in the bloodstream."
Donna, her arms crossed across her chest, shook her head sadly.
"It's a shame, the way these middle-aged businessmen just drop like flies. All sorts of health issues. They drink too much, eat too well, don't take enough exercise. I'm sure this gentleman here isn't like that."
"You'd hope not, but who knows?"
Mr. Garside seems to have shrunk by several inches. "And don't even think of threatening Lily. We know where you live, Mr. Garside. All paramedics have that information to hand if and when they need it. It's amazing what can happen if you piss off a paramedic."
"This is outrageous!"
He was blustering now, his face drained of colour.
"Yep, it really is," I held out my hand.
"The phone, please." Garside glanced around him again, then finally reached into his pocket and handed it to me. I tossed it to Lily.
"Check it, Lily."
I looked away, in deference to her feelings, while she did so.
"Delete it," I said. "Just delete it."
When I looked back, she had the phone screen blank in her hand. She gave a faint nod. Sam motioned to her to throw it to him. He dropped it to the floor and stamped down on it with his right foot so that the plastic splintered. He crushed it with such violence that the floor shook. I found myself flinching along with Mr. Garside every time Sam's heavy boot came down. Finally, Sam stooped and gingerly picked up the tiny SIM card which had skidded under the radiator. He examined it and held it up in front of the older man.
"Was that the only copy?"
Garside nodded. Moisture was darkening his collar.
"Of course it's the only copy," said Donna.
"A responsible member of the community wouldn't want to take the risk of something like that turning up anywhere, would he? Imagine what Mr. Garside's family would say if his nasty little secret got out." Garside's mouth had compressed into a thin line.
"You've got what you wanted. Now let me leave."
"No, I would like to say something. My voice, I noted distantly, shook slightly with the effort of containing my fury. You are a sleazy, pathetic little man, and if I... Mr. Garside's mouth hooked upwards in a sneer. The kind of man who had never once felt threatened by a woman.
Oh, do be quiet, you ridiculous little...
Something hard glittered in Sam's eyes, and he sprang forward. My arm shot out to restrain him. I don't remember my other fist pulling back. I do remember the pain that shot through my knuckles as it made contact with the side of Garside's face. He reeled backwards, his upper body hitting the door, and I stumbled, not expecting the force of the impact. When he righted himself, I was shocked to see blood trickling from his nose.
Let me out, he hissed through his fingers. This minute!
Sam blinked at me, then unlocked the door. Donna stepped away, just about allowing him through. She leaned towards him. Are you sure you don't want a dressing for that before you go? Garside kept his pace measured as he left, but as the door clicked shut behind him, we heard the sound of his expensive shoes picking up into a run down the corridor. We stood in silence until we couldn't hear them anymore, and then the sound of several people exhaling at once.
Nice punch, Cassius, said Sam after a minute. Want me to look at that hand?
I couldn't speak. I was bent double, swearing silently into my chest.
Always hurts more than you think it will, doesn't it? Said Donna, patting my back. Don't stress, sweetheart, she told Lily. Whatever he said to you, that old man is nothing. Gone.
He won't be back, said Sam.
Donna laughed. He pretty much crapped himself. I think he'll be running a mile from you from now on.
Forget it, darling. She hugged Lily briskly, as you might someone who had toppled off a bike, then handed me the pieces of the broken phone to throw away.
Right. I promised to pop round my dad's before our shift. See you later.
And then with a wave she was gone, her boots clumping cheerfully down the corridor. Sam began to rummage through his medical pack to find a dressing for my hand. Lily and I walked into the living room where she sank on the sofa.
You did brilliantly, I told her. You were pretty badass yourself.
I examined my bloody knuckles. When I looked up, the smallest grin was playing around her lips.
He totally wasn't expecting that.
Neither was I. I'd never hit anyone before. I straightened my face.
Not that, you know, you should consider me any kind of moral example.
I've never considered you any kind of example, Lou. She grinned, almost reluctantly, as Sam came in, bearing some sterile bandage and a pair of scissors.
You okay, Lily?
He raised his eyebrows. She nodded.
Good. Let's move on to something more interesting. Who fancies spaghetti carbonara?
When she left the room, he let out a long breath, then stared at the ceiling for a moment as if composing himself.
What? I said. Thank God you hit him first. I was afraid I was going to kill him.
Sometime later, after Lily had gone to bed, I joined Sam in the kitchen. For the first time in weeks, some sort of peace had descended over my home. She's happier already. I mean, she bitched about the new toothpaste and left her towels on the floor, but in Lily terms, she's definitely better. He nodded at this and emptied the sink. It felt good having him in my kitchen. I watched him for a minute, wondering how it would feel to walk up and place my arms around his waist. Thank you, I said, for everything. He turned, wiping his hands on the tea towel.
You were pretty smart yourself, Punchy.
He reached out a hand and pulled me to him. We kissed. There was something so delicious about his kisses, the softness of them compared to the brute strength of the rest of him. I lost myself in him for a moment, but...
What?
He said, pulling back.
What's wrong?
You're going to think it's weird.
More weird than this evening.
I keep thinking about that dihypranol stuff. How much would it take to actually kill a person? I mean, is this something you all carry routinely?
It sounds really dodgy.
You don't need to worry, he said.
Well, you say that, but what if someone really hated you? Could they put it in your food? I mean, could terrorists get hold of it? I mean, how much would they actually need?
Lou, there's no such drug.
What?
I made it up. There's no such thing as dihypranol. Totally invented. He grinned at my shocked face.
Funnily enough, I don't think I've ever had a drug that worked better.
Chapter 22. I was the last one to arrive at the moving on meeting. My car wouldn't start again and I'd have to wait for the bus. When I got there, the biscuit tin was just closing, a signal that the real business of the evening was about to begin. "Today we're going to talk about faith in the future," Mark said. I muttered my apology and sat down. "Oh, and we only have an hour today because of an emergency scouts meeting. Sorry about that, guys." Mark fixed each of us with his special empathetic gaze. He was very keen on his special empathetic gaze. Sometimes he would stare at me for so long I wondered if something was poking out of my nostril. He looked down, as if gathering his thoughts, or perhaps he liked to read his opening lines from a pre-prepared script. "When someone we love is snatched from us, it often feels very hard to make plans. Sometimes people feel like they have lost faith in the future, or they become superstitious."
"I thought I was going to die," said Natasha.
"You are," said William. "Not helpful, William," said Mark. "No, honestly, for the first 18 months after Olaf died, I thought I had cancer. I think I went to the doctor about a dozen times, convinced I was getting cancer. Brain tumours, pancreatic cancer, womb cancer, even little finger cancer."
"There's no such thing as little finger cancer," said William.
"Oh, how would you know?" snapped Natasha. "You have a smart answer for everything, William, but sometimes you should just keep your mouth shut, okay? It gets very tedious having you make a snarky comment about everything that someone says in this group. I thought I had little finger cancer. My GP sent me for tests, and it turned out I didn't. It might have been an irrational fear, yes, but you don't have to put down everything I say, because whatever you think, you don't know everything, okay?"
There was a brief silence.
"Actually," said William, "I work on an oncology ward." "It still stands," she said after a microsecond. "You are insufferable, a deliberate agitator, a pain in the backside."
"That's true," said William.
Natasha stared at the floor. Or perhaps we all did. It was hard to tell, given I was studying the floor. She put her face into her hands for a moment and then looked up at him. "You're not really, William. I'm sorry. I think I'm just having one of those days. I didn't mean to snap at you like that."
"Still can't get little finger cancer, though," said William.
"So," said Mark, as we tried to ignore Natasha cursing repeatedly under her breath, "I'm wondering whether any of you have reached a point where you can consider the prospect of life 5 years on. Where do you see yourself? What do you see yourself doing? Do you feel okay to imagine the future now?"
"I'll be happy if my old tick is still ticking," said Fred.
"All that internet sex putting it under strain," said Sunil.
"That," exclaimed Fred, "that was a total waste of money. The first site I spent 2 weeks emailing this woman from Lisbon, total cracker, and when I finally suggested we meet up for a bit of old how's your father, she tried to sell me a condo in Florida. And then a man called Buffed Adonis private messaged me to warn me off and tell me she was actually a one-legged Puerto Rican fellow called Ramirez."
"What about the other sites, Fred?"
"The only woman who said she'd meet me looked like my great aunt Elsie, who kept her keys in her knickers. I mean, she was very sweet and all, but the old girl was so ancient, I was almost tempted to check."
"Don't give up, Fred," said Mark. "It might be that you're looking in the wrong places."
"For my keys? Oh, no. I hang those by the door."
Daphne decided she'd like to retire abroad in the next few years. "It's the cold here. Gets into my joints." Leanne said she hoped to finish her philosophy masters. We gave each other the kind of deliberately blank looks you do when nobody wants to admit they had actually assumed she worked in a supermarket.
"Or maybe a slaughterhouse,"
William said.
"Well, you can't."
Nobody laughed, and when he realised nobody was going to, he sat back in his chair. And it might have been only me who heard Natasha muttering, "Ha ha," like Nelson in The Simpsons. At first, Sunil didn't want to speak. Then he said he'd thought about it, and he decided that in 5 years' time he'd like to be married. "I feel like I've turned myself off for the past 2 years, like I wouldn't let anyone get close to me because of what happened. I mean, what's the point of getting close to someone if you're only going to lose them? But the other day I started thinking about what I actually want out of life, and I realised it was someone to love. Because you've got to move on, right? You've got to see some kind of future." It was the most I had heard Sunil speak in any meeting since I had started coming.
"That's very positive, Sunil," said Mark. "Thank you for sharing."
I listened to Jake talk about going to college and how he wanted to train as an animator and wondered absently where his father would be. Still weeping over his dead wife? Or happily ensconced with some new aversion? I suspected the latter. Then I thought about Sam and wondered whether my offhand reference to a relationship had been wise. Then I wondered what we were in if it wasn't a relationship.
because there were relationships and relationships. And even as I mulled this over, I realised that if he asked, I wasn't sure which category we even fitted into. I couldn't help wondering whether the intensity of our search for Lily had acted out as a kind of cheap glue, binding us together too quickly. What did we have in common other than a fall from a building? 2 days previously, I'd gone to the ambulance station to wait for Sam, and Donna had stood by her car chatting to me for a few minutes while he gathered his belongings. Don't mess him around. I turned, not sure if I had heard her correctly. She had watched as an ambulance was unloaded by the shutters, and then rubbed her nose. He's all right for a great lunk, and he really likes you. I hadn't known what to say. He does. He's been talking about you, and he doesn't talk about anyone. Don't tell him I said anything. He's all right. I just want you to know. She had raised her eyebrows at me then and nodded as if confirming something to herself. I've just realised you're not in your dancing girl outfit, said Daphne. There was a murmur of recognition. Did you get promoted? I was dragged from my thoughts. Oh, no. I got fired. Where are you working now? Nowhere yet. But your outfit. I was wearing my little black dress with the white collar. Oh, this? It's just a dress.
I thought you were working at a themed bar for secretaries, or maybe French maids.
Don't you ever stop, Fred.
You don't understand. At my age, the phrase, use it or lose it, takes on a certain urgency. I might only have 20 or so stiffies left in me.
Some of us have never had 20 stiffies in us in the first place. We paused to give Fred and Daphne time to stop giggling. And your future? It sounds like it's all changed for you, said Mark. Well, I actually got offered another job. You did? There was a little ripple of applause, which made me blush.
Oh, I'm not going to take it, but it's fine. I feel I've sort of moved on, just for being offered a job.
William said,
what was the job?
Oh, just something in New York. They all stared at me.
You got a job offer in New York?
Yes.
A paid job?
With accommodation, I said quietly.
And you wouldn't have to wear that god-awful shiny green dress?
Well, I hardly think my outfit was a good enough reason to emigrate, I laughed. Nobody else did.
Oh, come on, I said.
They were all staring at me. Leanne's mouth might actually have been hanging open a little.
New York, New York?
Look, you don't know the whole story. I can't go now. I have Lily to sort out. The daughter of your ex-employer? Jake was frowning at me. Well, he was more than my employer, but yes. Does she have no family of her own, Louisa? Daphne leaned forward. It's complicated. They all looked at each other. Mark put his pad on his lap. How much do you feel you've really learned from these sessions, Louisa? I had received the package from New York, a bundle of documents with immigration and health insurance forms clipped together with a thick piece of cream notepaper, on which Mr. Leonard M. Gopnik forwarded me a formal offer to work for his family. I had locked myself into the bathroom to read it, then read it a second time, converted the salary into pounds, sighed for a bit, and promised myself I would not Google the address. After I'd Googled the address, I resisted the brief urge to lie on the floor in a fetal position. Then I got a grip, stood up and flushed the loo, in case Lily wondered what I was doing in there, washed my hands, out of habit, and took it all into my bedroom where I stuffed it into the drawer under my bed and told myself I would never look at it again. That night she had knocked on my bedroom door shortly before midnight. Can I stay here? I don't really want to go back to my mum's. You can stay as long as you want. She had lain down on the other side of my bed and curled up in a little ball. I watched her sleep, then pulled the duvet over her. Will's daughter needed me. It was as simple as that. And whatever my sister said, I owed him. Here was a way to feel I hadn't been completely useless. I could still do something for him. And that envelope proved I was someone who could get a decent job offer. That was progress. I had friends. A sort of boyfriend, even. This, too, was progress. I ignored Nathan's missed calls and deleted his voicemail messages. I would explain it all to him in a day or two. It felt, if not like a plan, then as close to one as I was going to get right now. Sam was due shortly after I got back on Tuesday. He texted at 7 to say he was going to be late. He sent another at 8:15 saying he wasn't sure what time he would make it.
I'd felt flat all day, struggling with the stasis that comes from not having a job to go to. Worries about how I was going to pay my bills, and being trapped in an apartment with someone else who, similarly, had nowhere to go and was unwilling to leave by herself. At 9:30 the buzzer went. Sam was at the front door, still in uniform. I let him in and stepped out into the corridor, closing the front door behind me. He emerged from the stairwell and walked towards me in uniform, his head down. He was grey with exhaustion and gave off a strange, disturbed energy. "I thought you weren't coming. What happened? Are you okay?"
"I'm being hauled up in front of disciplinary."
"What?"
"Another crew saw my rig outside the night we met Garside. They told control. I couldn't give them a good answer as to why we were attending something that wasn't on the system."
"So what happened?"
"I fudged it. Said someone had come running out and asked us for help and that it had turned out to be a prank. Donna backed me up, thank God, but they're not happy."
"Well, it's not that bad, surely."
"And one of the A&E nurses asked Lily how she knew me, and she said I'd given her a lift home from a nightclub."
My hand went to my mouth. "What does that mean?"
"The union's arguing my case, but if they find against me, I'll be suspended. Or worse."
A new deep furrow had etched its way between his brows. "Because of us. Oh, Sam, I'm so sorry."
He shook his head. "She wasn't to know."
I was going to step forward and hold him then, to put my arms around him, rest my face against his. But something held me back. A sudden, unbidden image of Will turning his face away from me, unreachable in his unhappiness. I faltered then a second too late, reached out a hand instead and touched Sam's arm. He glanced down at it, frowning slightly, and I had the slightly discomforting sensation that he knew something of what had just passed through my head.
"You could always give it up and raise your chickens, build your house."
I heard my voice trying too hard.
"You've got options, a man like you. You could do anything."
He gave a half smile that didn't reach his eyes. He kept staring at my hand. We stood there for an awkward moment. "I'd better go." "Oh," he said, holding out a parcel.
"Someone left this by the door. I didn't think it would last long in your lobby."
"Come in, please." I took it from him, feeling I had let him down.
"Let me cook you something badly.
Come on. I'd better get home." He walked back down the corridor before I could say anything else. From the window I watched him leave, walking stiffly back to his motorbike, and I felt a momentary cloud pass over me again. "Don't get too close." And then I remembered Mark's advice at the end of the last session. "Understand that your grieving, anxious brain is simply responding to cortisol spikes. It is perfectly natural to be fearful of getting close to anyone." Some days I felt as if I had two cartoon advisers constantly arguing on each side of my head. In the living room, Lily turned away from the television. "Was that Ambulance Sam?"
"Yeah."
She went back to the television. Then the parcel grabbed her attention.
"What's that?"
"Oh, it was in the lobby. It's addressed to you." She stared suspiciously at it, as if she was still too conscious of the possibility of unpleasant surprises. Then she peeled back the layers of wrapping to reveal a leather-bound photograph album, its cover embossed with "For Lily, Trainer." She opened it slowly, and there on the first page, covered with tissue, was the black-and-white photograph of a baby. Underneath it was a handwritten note. "Your father weighed 9 pounds 2 ounces. I was absolutely furious with him for being so big, as I'd been told I'd have a nice small one. He was a very cross baby and kept me running ragged for months. But when he smiled, oh, old ladies would cross the road to tickle his cheeks. He hated this, of course." I sat down beside her. Lily flicked forward 2 pages, and there was Will, in a royal blue prep school uniform and cap, scowling at the camera. The note underneath read, "Will hated that school cap so much that he hid it in the dog's basket. The second one he lost in a pond. The third time his father threatened to stop his pocket money, but he simply traded football cards until he'd made it back. Even the school couldn't make him wear it. I think he had weekly detention until he was 13. Lily touched his face. "I looked like him when I was small."
"Well,"
I said.
"He's your dad."
She allowed herself a small smile, then turned to the next page. "Look at this one." In the next photograph, he smiled directly out at the camera, the same skiing holiday picture that had been in his bedroom when we had first met. I gazed at his beautiful face, and the familiar wave of sadness passed over me. And then, unexpectedly, Lily started to laugh.
"Look at this one!"
Will, his face covered with mud after a rugby game. Another where he was dressed as a devil, taking a running jump off a haystack. A page of silliness. Will is a prankster, laughing, human. I thought of the tight sheet Mark had given me after I had missed idealization week. It is important not to turn the dead into saints. Nobody can walk in the shadow of a saint. I wanted you to see your father before his accident. He was fiercely ambitious and professional, yes, but I also remember times where he slid off his chair laughing, or danced with the dog, or came home covered with bruises because of some ridiculous dare. He once shoved his sister's face into a bowl of sherry trifle, picture on, right? Because she had said he wouldn't, and I wanted to be cross with him as it had taken me simply ages to make. But you really could never be cross with Will for very long. No, you never could. Lily flipped through the other pictures, all with little notes beside them. This Will, rising from the pages, was not a two-line piece in a newspaper, a careful obituary, a solemn photograph illustrating a sad tale in a long-running legal debate. This was a man, alive, three-dimensional. I gazed at each picture, distantly aware of each lump in my throat as it rose and was overcome. A card slid out onto the floor. I picked it up and scanned the two-line message. "She wants to come and see you." Lily could barely tear her eyes from the album. "What do you think, Lily? Are you up for it?" It took her a moment to hear me. "I don't think so. I mean, it's nice, but..." The mood changed. She closed the leather cover, put it neatly to the side of the sofa, and turned back to the television. A few minutes later, without saying a word, she moved up the sofa beside me and let her head fall onto my shoulder. That night after Lily had gone to bed, I emailed Nathan. "I'm sorry, I can't take it. It's a long story, but I have Will's daughter living with me, and a lot has been going on, and I can't up and leave her. I have to do what's right. I'll try to explain in brief." I ended, "Thank you for thinking of me." I emailed Mr. Gopnik, thanking him for his offer, and stating that due to a change in circumstances, I was very sorry, but I wouldn't be able to take the job. I wanted to write more, but the huge knot in my stomach seemed to have drained all the energy from my fingertips. I waited an hour, but neither of them responded. When I walked back into the empty living room to turn off the lights, the photograph album was gone. Chapter 23.
Well, well, if it isn't the employee of the year.
I put the bag containing my uniform and wig down on the counter. The tables of the Shamrock and Clover were already full by breakfast time. A plump 40-something businessman, whose drooping head suggested an early start on the hard stuff, gazed blearily up at me, cradling his glass between fat hands. Vera was at the far end, angrily shifting tables and people's feet to sweep under them as if she were chasing mice. I was wearing a man-style blue shirt. It was easier to feel confident if you were wearing men's clothes, I had decided, and observed, distantly, that it was almost the same shade as Richard's. "Richard, I wanted to talk to you about what happened last week." Around us, the airport was half full of bank holiday passengers. There were fewer suits than usual, and an undertow of small, crying children. Behind the till, a new banner offered the chance to get your trip off to a good start. Coffee, croissant, and a chaser. Richard moved briskly around the bar, placing newly filled cups of coffee and plastic-wrapped cereal bars on a tray, his brow furrowed in concentration.
"Don't bother. Is the uniform clean?"
He reached past me for the plastic bag and pulled out my green dress. He scanned it carefully under the strip lights, his face set in a half grimace, as if he were primed to spot unsavoury marks. I half expected him to sniff it. "Of course it's clean.
It needs to be in a suitable condition for a new employee to wear."
"It was washed yesterday," I snapped. I noticed suddenly that a new version of Celtic Panpipes was playing. Fewer harp strings, heavy on the flute.
"Right, we have some paperwork in the back that you need to sign. I'll go and get it, and you can do that here. And that's it."
"Maybe we could just do this somewhere a bit more private?" Richard Percival didn't look at me.
"Too busy, I'm afraid. I have 100 things to do, and I'm one staff member down today."
He bustled past me officiously, counting aloud the remaining bags of scampi fries hanging by the optics.
6, 7. Vera, can you serve that gentleman over there, please?
Yes, well, that's what I wanted to talk to you about. I was wondering if there was any way you...
8, 9... The wig?
What?
Where's the wig?
Oh, here. I reached into my bag and pulled it out. I had brushed it before putting it in its own bag. It sat like a piece of blonde roadkill, waiting to make some other person's head itch.
Did you wash it?
Wash the wig?
Yes. It's unhygienic for somebody else to put it on without you washing it first.
It's made of cheaper synthetic fibres than a cut-price Barbie's. I assumed it would basically melt in a washing machine.
If it's not in a suitable condition for a future staff member to wear, I'm going to have to charge you for a replacement.
I stared at him. You're charging me for the wig? He held it up, then stuffed it back into the bag.
£28.40. I will, of course, provide you with a receipt.
Oh, my God! You really are going to charge me for the wig? I laughed. I stood in the middle of the crowded airport as the planes took off, and I thought about what my life had become working for this man. I pulled my purse from my pocket. Fine, I said. £28.40, you say? Tell you what, I'll round it up to 30, you know, to include administrative expenses.
You don't need to.
I counted out the notes and slammed them onto the bar in front of him. You know something, Richard? I like working. If you'd looked beyond your bloody targets for 5 minutes, you would have seen that I was somebody who actually wanted to do well. I worked hard. I wore your horrific uniform, even though it turned my hair static, and made small children jig in the street behind me. I did everything you asked, including cleaning men's loos, which I'm pretty sure was not in my contract, and which, in actual employment law, I'm sure should have meant the provision of a Hazchem suit at least. I stood in for extra shifts while you searched for new bartenders because you've alienated every single member of staff who ever came through this door. And I have upsold your wretched dry-roasted peanuts even though they smell like someone breaking wind. But I am not an automaton. I am human and I have a life. And just for a short while, I had responsibilities that meant I couldn't be the employee you or I would have liked. I came here today to ask for my job back. Actually, to beg for my job back, as I still have responsibilities and I want a job. I need a job. But I just realised I don't want this one. I'd rather work for free than spend another day in this miserable, soul-destroying, pan-pipe-chuffing bar. I would rather clean toilets for free than work one more day for you. So thank you, Richard. You've actually prompted my first positive decision in as long as I can remember. I rammed my purse back into my bag, pushed the wig towards him and made to leave.
You can stick your job in the same place you can stick those peanuts.
I turned back. Oh, and that thing you do with your hair? All that gel stuff and the perfectly even topping? Awful. It makes you look like Action Man. The businessman sat up on his bar stool and gave a little round of applause. Richard's hand went involuntarily to his head. I glanced at the businessman, then back at Richard. Actually, forget that last bit. That was mean. And I left. I was striding across the concourse, my heart still thumping when I heard him.
Louisa! Louisa!
Richard was half walking, half running behind me. I considered ignoring him, but finally came to a halt by the perfume concession. What? I said. Did I miss a peanut crumb? He stopped, puffing slightly. He studied the shop window for a few seconds as if he was thinking. Then he faced me. You're right. Okay? You're right. I stared at him. The Shamrock and Clover. It's a horrible place, and I know I've not been the greatest to work for. But all I can tell you is that for every miserable directive I give you, my nuts are being squeezed 10 times harder by head office. My wife hates me because I'm never home. The suppliers hate me because I have to cut their margins every single week because of pressure from shareholders. My regional manager says I'm underperforming on units shifted, and if I don't pull it out of the bag, I'm going to be sent to the North Wales passenger ferry branch, at which point my wife will actually leave me, and I won't blame her. I hate managing people. I have the social skills of a lamppost, which is why I can't hang on to anyone. Vera only says she stays because she has the skin of a rhino, and I suspect she's secretly after my job. So there. I'm sorry. I'd actually quite like to give you your job back, because whatever I said earlier... You were pretty good. Customers liked you. He sighed and looked out over the milling crowds around us.
But you know what, Louisa? You should get out while you can. You're pretty, you're smart, hard-working. You could get something way better than this. If I wasn't locked into a mortgage that I can barely afford, a baby on the way, and payments to make on a frickin' Honda Civic that makes me feel about 120 years old, believe me, I'd be taken off out of here faster than one of those planes.
He held out a hand with a payslip.
Your holiday pay. Now go. Seriously, Louisa. Get out.
I looked down at the little brown envelope in my hand. Around us, the passengers moved at a crawl, pausing at outlet windows, checking for vanished passports, oblivious to what was going on in their midst. And I knew, with a weary inevitability, what was going to happen. Richard, thanks for that, but could I still have the job? Even if it's just for a bit, I do actually really need it. Richard looked as if he couldn't believe what I was saying. Then he let out a sigh.
If you could do a couple of months, it would be a massive relief. I'm right up the proverbial creek here. In fact, if you could start now, I could make it over to the wholesalers to pick up the new beer mats.
We swapped places, a little waltz of mutual disappointment. I'll call home, I said.
Oh, here, he said.
We gazed at each other a moment longer. Then he handed me the plastic bag containing my uniform.
I guess you'll be needing this.
Richard and I settled into a routine of sorts. He treated me with a little more consideration, only asking me to do the gents on the days when Noah, the new cleaner, failed to turn up, not commenting if he thought I was spending too long talking to customers, even if he did look a bit pained. In turn, I was cheerful and punctual and careful to upsell when I could. I felt an odd responsibility towards his nuts. One day he took me to one side and said that, while it was possibly a little premature, head office had told him they were looking to elevate one of the permanent staff to an assistant managerial position, and if things carried on the way they were, he felt very much inclined to put my name forward.
I can't risk promoting Vera. She'd put floor cleaner in my tea to get my job.
I thanked him and tried to look more delighted than I felt. Lily, meanwhile, asked Samir for a job, and he said he would take her for a half-day's trial if she would do it for free. I handed her a coffee at 7:30 and made sure she left the flat dressed and ready in time for her 8 o'clock start. When I returned home that evening, she had apparently got the job, albeit on £2.73 an hour, which I discovered was the lowest rate he could legally pay her. She had spent most of the day moving crates in the back storeroom and putting prices on tins with an ancient sticker gun, while Samir and his cousin watched football on his iPad. She was filthy and exhausted, but curiously happy. If I last a month, he says he'll consider putting me on the till. I had a shift change, so on Thursday afternoon we drove to Lily's parents' house in St. John's Wood. And I waited in the car while Lily went in and collected some more clothes and the Kandinsky print that she had promised would look good in my flat. She emerged 20 minutes later, her face furious and closed. Tanya walked out into the porch, her arms folded, watching silently as Lily opened the boot and threw in the overstuffed hold-all and more carefully the print. Then she climbed into the front seat and gazed straight ahead at the empty road. As Tanya closed the door behind her, there was a small possibility that she was wiping her eyes. I put my key into the ignition. "When I grow up," Lily said, and perhaps only I could have detected the faint tremor in her voice, "I am not going to be anything like my mother." I waited a moment, then started the car, and we drove in silence back to my flat. "Fancy the pictures tonight? I could do with some escapism. I don't think I should leave Lily. Bring her?" "I'd better not. Sorry, Sam. Kiss." That evening I found Lily on the fire escape. She looked up at the sound of the window opening and waved a cigarette. "Thought it was a bit mean to keep smoking in your flat, given that you don't." I wedged the window open, climbed out carefully, and sat down on the iron steps beside her. Below us the car park simmered in the August heat, the scent of hot tarmac rising into the still air. A car with the bonnet up thumped bass from its sound system. The metal of the steps retained the warmth of a month of sunny afternoons, and I leaned back, closing my eyes. "I thought it would all work out," Lily said. I opened them. "I thought if I could just get Peter to go away, all my problems would be solved. I thought if I could find my dad, I would feel like I belonged somewhere. And now Peter's gone, and Garside's gone, and I know about my dad, and I have you. But nothing feels like I expected." I was about to tell her not to be silly. I was about to point out that she had come such a long way in a short time, that she had her first job, prospects, a bright future. The standard adult responses. But they sounded trite and patronising. At the end of the road, a bunch of office workers huddled round a metal table by the pub's rear door. Later tonight, it would be packed with hipsters and strays from the city, spilling out with drinks across the pavement, their raucous calls filtering in through my open window. "I know what you mean," I said. "I've been waiting to feel normal again since your dad died. I feel like I'm basically going through the motions. I'm still in a crappy job. I still live in this flat, which I don't think is ever going to feel like home. I had a near-death experience, but I can't say it gave me wisdom or gratitude for life or anything. I go to a grief counselling group full of people who are as stuck as I am, but I haven't really done anything." Lily thought about this. "You help me. That's pretty much the one thing I hang on to most days. And you have a boyfriend. He's not my boyfriend." "Sure, Louisa." We watched the traffic crawl down towards the city. Lily took a final drag of her cigarette and stubbed it out on the metal step. "That's my next thing," I said. She had the grace to look slightly guilty. "I know. I will stop, I promise." Across the rooftops, the sun had started to slide, its orange glow diffused by the lead-grey air of the city evening. "You know, Lily, perhaps some things just take longer than others." "I think we'll get there, though." She linked her arm through mine and let her head rest on my shoulder. We watched the sun's gentle fall and the lengthening shadows creeping towards us. And I thought about the New York skyline, and that nobody was truly free. Perhaps all freedom, physical, personal, only came at the cost of somebody or something else. The sun vanished and the orange sky began to turn petrol blue. When we stood up, Lily smoothed her skirt, then gazed at the packet in her hand. She pulled the remaining cigarettes abruptly from the wrapper and snapped them in half, then flung them into the air, a confetti of tobacco and white paper. She looked at me triumphantly and held up her hand. "There, I am officially a smoke-free zone." "Just like that." "Why not? You said it might take longer than we thought. Well, that's my first step. What's yours?" "Oh, God, maybe I'll persuade Richard to let me stop wearing that god-awful nylon wig. That would be an excellent first step. It would be nice not to get an electric shock off every door handle in your flat." Her smile was infectious. I took the empty cigarette packet from her before she could litter the car park with that too, and stood back so she could climb through the window. She stopped and turned to me, as if she had suddenly thought of something. "You know, falling in love with someone else doesn't mean that you loved my dad any less. You don't have to be sad just to stay connected to him." I stared at her. "It's just a thought," she shrugged and climbed back in through the window. I woke the next day to find that Lily had already gone to work. She left a note saying she would bring some bread home at lunchtime as we were a bit short. I had drunk some coffee, had breakfast and put on my trainers to go for a walk. "Mark, exercise is as good for your spirit as it is for your body." When my mobile rang, a number I didn't recognise. "Hello!" It took me a minute. "Mum?" "Look out your window!" I walked across the living room and gazed out. My mother was on the pavement waving vigorously. "What? What are you doing here? Where's Dad?" "He's at home." "Is Grandad okay?" "Grandad's fine." "But you never come to London by yourself. You don't even go past the petrol station without Dad in tow." "Well, it was about time I changed, wasn't it? Shall I come up? I don't want to use up all the minutes on my new phone." I buzzed her in and went around the living room clearing the worst of last night's dishes. And by the time she reached the door, I was standing there, arms open, ready to greet her. She was wearing her good anorak, her handbag slung satchel style over her shoulder, harder for muggers to snatch it, and her hair styled into soft waves around her neck. She was beaming, her lips carefully outlined in coral pink lipstick and clutching the family A to Z, which dated back to some time around 1983. "I can't believe you came by yourself. Isn't it wonderful? I actually feel quite giddy. I told a young man on the tube that it was the first time I'd been on the underground in 30 years without someone holding my hand. And he moved a full four seats down the carriage. I got quite hysterical with laughter. Will you put the kettle on?" She sat pulling off her coat and gazed at the walls around her. "Well now, the green is interesting." Lily's choice. I wondered fleetingly if her arrival was some great joke and Dad was about to barrel in through my front door laughing what a great idiot